And it is true that some years ago, the last time I went to UK, which was about 4 or 5 years ago, that I met one of my old friends, you know, from Cambridge, and he is what we call an actuary. An actuary is a person who works out the mathematics of insurance risk. And before I met him, he checked me out on the website, and he did say, Adrian Brahm, you are now a brand. In other words, you can actually use the popularity actually to spread some of the great teachings of the Buddha, not just to Buddhists, but to everybody, to enhance their lives in all the different areas of modern human life. And of course, most people spend a huge proportion of their life at work, in the offices, in the boardrooms. And this is such an important part of human existence that it is necessary for someone like me to help assist you, you know, in the struggles and the problems of, you know, corporate life. And there is no reason that why we cannot assist in those areas. And indeed, at that World Computer Conference a few years ago in Brisbane, I just gave a little message. And from there, it went into the Australian newspaper, the National Daily in Australia. And from there, it went to the Australian Stock Exchange website as advice to the brokers. And from there, it went to the Harvard Business School, where you can now find it as advice in one of the most prestigious business schools of our world. And I'm very pleased at how wide this has been disseminated as a very simple means of overcoming stress in the workplace, especially in the boardroom. Because at a recent event, the mayor of Perth City, when she gave her speech, she said, I learned this simile from somebody. And it was my simile, and I told her afterwards, I invented that one. And she was so pleased and surprised that she'd heard it in a roundabout way. This is the first simile, practical Buddhism for everybody, so that you can lessen the stress in your workplace, increase your efficiency, get more done for less work, which is what business wants. And it's a simile of how heavy is a glass of water. If you've seen this before, please bear with me so you can see it again, because this is practical advice. How heavy is this glass of water? The longer I hold it, the heavier it feels. After 1 minute, I start to get tired. After 2 minutes, I'm in pain. After 5 minutes, I am in agony and a very stupid bhikkhu. What should I do when this starts to get too heavy to hold comfortably? You just put it down for a couple of minutes. Even 30 seconds will be enough. Because after 30 seconds of resting your arm, when you pick it up again afterwards, it is much easier to hold. This is the meaning of stress in the workplace and the inefficiency of people who work in the highest levels of business. They keep on working even though their brain is exhausted and is not working efficiently. They think I have to keep working on the project because there's not enough time to complete it. And what they do is they waste so much time and their productivity is down, the quality of their decisions is poor. And instead, I ask people, when your brain gets too tired, too stressed to make good decisions, relax, rest, meditate, listen to some music, anything, but don't think about the business. Relax. Because if you just spend 10, 15 minutes, half an hour relaxing, you are re-energizing your human brain, making it clear, so when you go back to the project afterwards, your brain is now efficient again. It can see through all of the difficult things you have to consider and make a wise decision, you increase your productivity of your human brain. And if you think that you cannot afford half an hour in the middle of the day to meditate or to relax, you are missing the point. In Harvard Business School, they call that an investment for the afternoon. Half an hour of rest is invested, which means you get 4 hours work done in 3 hours of much higher quality. Now you can see the logic in that. And that is coming from basic understanding of the work of the human mind by a Buddhist monk who has spent all his life meditating and seeing how this human mind actually works. And this means that you can achieve much more in your workplace by investing time for resting. And your children who have to study hard, they too, I've seen this in all parts of our modern world, education is always so competitive that even your children spend hour after hour after hour on their computer screen doing an assignment, sometimes late into the night when their mind is just not working at its full potential. And so I'll even teach the children, for goodness sake, when you know that your brain is tired, you can sit at that screen for an hour and get hardly anything done, that is being dumb. For goodness sake, turn the screen off, relax, do something other than your work. And then go back to the work after you've rested. Then your mind is clear, your productivity increases. Now, of course, in business, productivity is the key to success. Whether you're in Colombo or in Sydney, in Singapore or New York, you have huge competition. And the only way to succeed and go forward is increasing productivity. Okay, using this. Can you hear at the back? Is it clear at the back, or should I use this? Okay, if it's not clear, don't sit there being stupid. Please put your hand up, for goodness sake. So I mean, this is business, okay? This is not a Buddhist temple. So you can actually say things. So, by increasing efficiency, you increase productivity. And I don't mean by automation. I mean by using your workforce, making sure that they can do much more. By using their brain more efficiently. And that also means giving everybody enough rest. Because I don't mind saying this, I reached the last time. The last time I went to my franchise in Singapore, they told me that the whole admin department had resigned. And the reason was, you know, that they were very efficient, maybe in one sense, but they had very, very poor public skills. So everyone was so upset at each other, the whole admin resigned en masse. Now that is a good example that, you know, your people, yourself and the people you work with, that is the strength of your company. And if you don't know how to look after one another, you'll find that many people will leave your organization. And you may understand that human turnover is one of the great drains on any business. You have a person and you have trained them into a particular role. They know the job, they have the contacts, now everybody knows them, and then they leave for another job. And that is a great drain on your company. It takes at least, what business leaders tell me, at least 6 months, at least, to train someone up to that same level. So they know the job, know the suppliers, know the market, know the people. And that really is a big negative on your bottom line. So it is important in any business, even a Buddhist business, even in a Buddhist monastery, to keep your key people. And the way you keep your key people is very easy, simple kindness. basic compassion, spending time talking to the people who work with you, and even bonding with them just over a lunch or a dinner when you do anything except talk about business. Sometimes when we have meetings with our fellow managers or with our clients, that's all we talk about, business. Not understanding that that human connection, the relationship you build with the people who work with you or for you or the people you supply, is so important for success in any business. My business, the monk business, not monkey business, the monk business, I spend a lot of time developing relationships, you know, with all the important people I work with. So they trust me, I trust them, so it's very easy to work with people. And I found that's part of the success of, you know, being a monk in a modern world, and that's also, we can translate that into the office. I don't know how many times people tell me that the worst thing about going to the office is office politics and competition, you know, for the advancement, for the promotion. For goodness sake, a company is like a football team or like a cricket team. You have to work together. And a cricket team, when the batsman hits the ball, they've both got to run at the same time. If one runs and the other one stays still, they get a run out. I don't know how many run outs there are in your offices, simply because people don't know how to cooperate, learning how to work together. And to be able to do that, you know, we have things such as in Buddhism and many other religions, of being selfless, letting go of what you want for what we want. An example of that is going back to one of the core institutions of society, marriage. Part of my job is also to do blessings for marriages. And during those marriage ceremonies, I have great fun. First of all, looking straight into the eyes of the bride and saying to her, now you are a married woman. From this moment on, you must not think of yourself. And she always smiles sweetly and nods her head. Yes, I will not think of myself. Now this is not just Australian marriages. This is Asian marriages throughout the world. It's always the same. So when I turn to the man and say, now you are a married man, and you must not think of yourself either, he always pauses. But eventually he comes around and said, okay. And then still looking at the newly married man, I continue by saying, from this moment on, you must not think of her, your wife. And he gets confused. So now look quickly at the wife, said, now you're married, you must not think of him. Now this is called teaching by the method of confusion. Because when people are confused, they're actually paying attention. It's like a riddle, like a crossword puzzle. They pay attention, which means when I give them the answer to this riddle, they get it and they remember it. So I say, in a marriage, you should never think of yourself, nor should you think of your partner. In a marriage, you must only think of us. Not me, not him or her, but of us. You're in it together. So, if there's any problem, I continue, whose problem is it? And they always give the correct answer. It is our problem. In a marriage, it's not his problem. It's not her problem. It's never my problem. It is always our problem. And just that simple piece of insight saves a lot of difficulties in marriage. And now I extend that to the company. If there's a weak person in your company, whose problem is it? It's our problem, the whole company's problem. You know, just one person can bring Barings Bank down. One person's mistakes or stupidity can destroy your whole company, which is why in a company it's not his problem, it's not my problem, it's not her problem, it is always our problem. Now that is the key to working together, to cooperating, realizing that we are in this together. It is not my company. I never say the Bodhinyana is my monastery, it's our monastery. All the stakeholders are involved so that we can learn how to work together rather than working against each other. Many years ago, just before the unification in Germany after the Berlin Wall came down, one of my members migrated from what was then called West Germany, which at the time had one of the best economies in the world. I think it was parallel with Japan as being the leading economy of the whole world. And he told me that when he migrated to Australia, his friends said, oh, the West German economy was so successful because everyone in West Germany worked so hard. And he said, no, that is not true. Now, I am from West Germany. I worked there for so many years. We are not successful because we work hard. He said, we are successful because we cooperate and work together. And he described an Australian workforce. He said, you work against one another. He said, in West Germany, we work together in the same direction. And that is really important. In any company, to please take away the competition and get cooperation. How can you do that practically? Basically, if you are a CEO, a manager, please do not reward competition. Reward cooperation. Be aware of the people who can work with one another. The ones who have the emotional intelligence to be able to make those connections with others and work together, as they say, as a team, not as an individual. An example of that is the upcoming World Cup soccer. And I like reading it. I used to follow soccer, but unfortunately the team I used to follow always kept losing. It was so much suffering, that was one of the reasons I became a monk. But I still keep an interest in the game. And World Cup soccer coming up. And I notice there's all these great stars, these individual heroes, the Ronaldos, the Lionel Messis. These are people with such great skills at soccer. But you will find that not necessarily do their teams even get to the final and win. Because a team is not made of individuals. It's actually how they work together, how they combine. That will lead to success in a World Cup. And I remember Ajahn Bhumale, my third monk in Australia. He made the observation, if any of you follow English Premier League soccer, that Manchester United were always winning everything in the English Premier League until their manager, Alex Ferguson, resigned. And now they've got the same players, but they're not doing anywhere near so well. Which showed the power and importance of the coach, the person who can motivate the team and get them to work together as a unit, as 11 men, but 22 legs belonging to almost the same body. That is the skill of success in sport. And people in business look to such examples to have success in their business. It's not just getting just the best performer. It's not just getting a star manager or a star salesperson from another company. It's getting somebody who knows how to work together. So if you can reward
cooperation, what you are doing in your companies is attracting people who can work as a team, rather than wasting time working against one another in what is so well known as office politics. So don't promote the people who just achieve. Promote the people who can work together as a team. Those are the future of your company. I do manage to meet in my job. It's a fascinating job, being a monk. I thought when I became a Buddhist monk, I would just be sitting in a cave for the rest of my life, just meditating, doing nothing. Being so poor, you never get to meet important people. But this is not what actually happens. Just before I came here, and I gave a talk in Kuala Lumpur, and you know, with what I was told afterwards was the head CEOs of Kuala Lumpur, the movers and shakers in the Malaysian economy, were listening to my talk. I get to meet famous people, like Queen Elizabeth. I never thought as a Buddhist monk you would receive an invitation to a state dinner in Parliament House in Canberra with Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip. It was a weird experience, which I'm just going to expand upon, because I got the invitation from the then Prime Minister of Australia, John Howard. And of course, it was such a prestigious invitation, all my monks wanted me to go, until I saw there was a problem. The dress code. This was a state dinner in front of Queen Elizabeth. And so I read there were three options. The first option was black tie. And I was wondering, is that all you have to wear? Just a tie and nothing else? That's all it said. I don't know these things. I'm a simple monk. And they said, no, black tie means you have to wear the shirt and the trousers and everything else as well. So we didn't have a tie in our monastery, so I couldn't go with that. The second option, military uniform. You're a Buddhist monk. You can't wear military uniform. So I looked at the third option, and I realized, yes, I can go as that. The third option was long dress. This qualifies. So as a Buddhist monk, you can go to amazing places and meet with top CEOs and talk to them and understand them and get your understanding of the human mind through deep meditation. See the problems of modern business and solve them. One of the other stories, which is now taught in Harvard Business School, which comes from me, is lowering your expectations. Because many businesses fail because their expectations are way above what is humanly possible. Which means that you aim far too high. Everybody stresses, they can never attain, they lose their motivation, and their whole confidence vanishes. To understand what I mean, I learned this simple truth when I was a school teacher. I had to set an exam in mathematics. This was before I became a monk. And I've never set an exam before, so I asked for advice from a senior teacher. And he told me, do not set the exam too easy. Because if it is too easy and everyone gets 95, 96, 98% or even 100%, the exam is a waste of time. No one actually gets anything out of it. But he said if you make it too difficult, if everybody gets, so only say 30, 40%, they lose motivation. They will come away thinking they can't do maths. And so that is not a very good option. So this teacher told me, aim for the average score being 70%, 7 out of 10. Because then, 70% is a pretty good score. So all the children in your class, they will come away thinking they can do maths. They will retain their motivation. And the 30% where they make mistakes, that's where I, as their teacher, can learn their weak points. So the next lessons, I can focus on those weak points. I can find out what they didn't understand. And I realized that that piece of advice applied not just to mathematics. That applied to the whole of life. If you just always score 100% in life, always successful, even in business, you may have a good time, but you never learn anything. You never adapt to fill in the weaknesses and make things better. You will never improve. But if you set the sights too high and you're always failing, again, you feel you're a failure as a company. You're not successful. People lose their motivation and they leave. So the 70% rule is at the best in life. And I even say this for young people looking for a partner in life. Too many girls want a guy who's 100% or at least 95%. They can't find one, so they get one and try and make them into 95%. And they never achieve it, and they just get so frustrated. Guys just want beautiful girls. They want 100% as well, which means that the guys can never find a partner in life. If you are still single and looking for someone to share your life with, for goodness sake, lower your expectations. Uh-oh. And that's the same in business as well. Too high expectations of your bottom line, of your staff, and even of yourself will cripple your company and cripple, you know, your motivation. Motivation is the most important. And the other story I usually liked, which is why this lowering your expectations is also in Harvard Business School blog. Advice for CEOs of company, don't aim too high. You will fail, losing your motivation. Obviously, don't aim too low, but try 70%, not 100%. And then you'll be able to manage that, succeed and succeed and succeed every year. Please change expectations, adapt them. 70%, because most businesses have too high expectations. The same way women have too high expectations of their husbands. Husbands, too high expectations of their wives. And parents, too high expectation of your children. You're all very intelligent here, I hope. So you will understand that half of all children at school, half are below average intelligence. It's obvious, isn't it? That's just basic logic. Half of your children will be below average intelligence, but you think, not my children. Other children, yeah, but not mine. So don't expect too much of your children. You'll push them over the edge, just the way you push some of your workers over the edge with too high expectations. The other way is encouraging people. And to encourage people in business, in life, in monasteries, we always like to praise people. It's amazing how much more you get out of people if you praise them. I learned this a long time ago. Even, you know, my monastery, I started from nothing. As a monk. And I still got nothing, but we've got, you know, lots of good successes. But starting from such a poor base, you know, over in Australia, hardly any support. We had to build it up slowly. And I remember one of the first projects was building an ablution block in our monastery in Perth. We could not afford a builder. I had to learn how to do plumbing. Now, I remember when I was at Cambridge, I studied theoretical physics. I was all up here, nothing down here. So I had to learn to do plumbing. So all I did, I went to the shop, the big plumbing shop, and said, here are the plans, can you please help? And so the fellow selling me the plumbing bits, he explained how it all goes together. So we made the order, and I did it all myself. We had to get it passed by the health inspector of our local government. It did pass, first time. And so the same day I got the bill, so I got a check from our treasurer to pay the bill, and I sent a letter to the plumbing company saying, thank you for your help. Because of you, the plumbing passed. Thank you so much. Now, I was a very simple monk. I never realized this was a big company. And actually, the bill gets passed to the accounts department. And the accountant, or the person working in the accounts department, opened up the envelope and saw a letter. And straight away, she thought that must be another letter of complaint. Because in Australia, and I think maybe Sri Lanka as well, you only send a letter to a company to complain about something. But when this little clerk read the letter was actually praising them, it was so unique, she took it to the manager of the accounts department, who read it and took it straight to the CEO of this big company, because it was so rare to get a compliment. And the CEO picked up his phone and rang the branch where I bought this stuff and asked to speak to the person behind the counter who'd sold this to me, and said to him, Fred, that's wonderful. I've just read this letter of praise for your service to one of our customers. That's exactly what we want in our company, Fred. Great job. And by the way, what salary are you on? And the boss gave him a raise right there. And as it happened, that happened in the morning. I went into that plumbing shop in the afternoon to change a part. Now, this is in Australia. These plumbers in Australia are huge. They're very tough and strong, with no tattoos on them. And they were in line ahead of me. But as soon as Fred saw me, he said, Ajahn Brahm, come over here. So all these big guys had to wait while I was served first. And that's when Fred's friend told me what had happened that morning and why I was given VIP service. And I said, like, I got this part, it's too small, I need to make it bigger. He said, come round the back. And I said, there's a sign there, customers not allowed round the back. He said, that doesn't apply to you, come round the back. And I got the part changed. And it was twice as big and about four times as expensive. And so I said, how much do we owe you? And I always remember his smile. He said, Ajahn Brahm, for you, nothing. And so straight away, I realized the economic benefits. Of praising people. And it's amazing how rare that is in our world, especially in business. You find that if you praise a person, it's amazing how much they appreciate that and how much they want to work for you even harder. That is the way to get the best out of your workforce. But sometimes you need to criticize them. And criticizing people is one of the hardest things to do. No one likes to upset somebody. But sometimes if you're a CEO or a manager, you have to criticize people. But there is a way to do that. a Buddhist way of doing it. If you haven't heard this before, it's called the sandwich method. The sandwich method, if you're a CEO, a manager, and you have to tell someone they're not performing well, if you just go up to them and tell them off, just like people have told you off sometimes, you will think, I work so hard for this manager. I do so much extra work, and this, what he gives me back, he doesn't appreciate me. And instead of actually thinking that you may need some improvement, you just get very upset and you think you're not appreciated. Which means the relationship gets even worse. That's not the way to actually point out somebody's fault. Instead, you use sandwich method. You bring in that worker into your office, and first of all, you praise them. So I just wanted to tell you just how much we appreciate all the hard work you do in our company. The way you're always here, you know, before others, you stay back later on. You're always well-dressed. You've got lots of good friends here, and you've got lots of good relationship. We really appreciate that. You praise them, first of all. That's the first layer of bread in the sandwich. Because when you praise people, they actually open their ears, they listen. And after a little bit of praise, they're listening for some more. Yes, please tell me some more. And then when their ears are fully open, that's when you hit them with the criticism. But, you spend too much time at the coffee machine, whatever it is. You find that they listen to the complaint. And then you finish off with some more praise and appreciation. So they go away, from that little interview, knowing, yes, they are appreciated, all their good qualities are seen and valued, but they can improve, and they will improve. The sandwich method. It's much better than just telling a person off straight away. That doesn't work in personal management. And all of us have to do that. If any monk in my monastery misbehaves, that's how I tell them. Praise and praise and praise until they feel so soft, and that's when I tell them off. That is how to deal with your wife.
Praise her and tell how beautiful she is, what a great mother she is, how wonderful, how lucky you are of all the men in Colombo that she chose you. And she then be so soft, she said, but darling, you are spending too much on the credit card. I don't know if you heard about the man who gave his wife plastic surgery for their anniversary. Plastic surgery means he cut up all her credit cards. Oh, while I'm on that subject, about it was Valentine's Day. And on Valentine's Day, the husband asked his wife the day before, darling, what do you want for Valentine's Day? And she said, I don't need anything, darling. Just having you around is more than good enough. If you're a man and you've been married long enough, you know that's not what she means. Of course she wants something. So she said, no, look, I want to buy you something for Valentine's Day. What do you want? And then she said, well, you know, you're a CEO, darling. No, we've got the money. Let's get me something with diamonds in. Anything with diamonds in. So he said, okay, darling. And the next day for Valentine's Day, she received a packet of playing cards. That's only a funny story. It's not a recommendation. But in business, you have to be kind and caring to people, and you find that gives them motivation to actually just to want to work harder for you. You never underestimate just the power of a little bit of praise, a bit of encouragement, which actually gets people to work harder. And that's your resource. That's what makes things work. And not just the people who work in your company, but the people who are your suppliers, the people who are your customers,
that company loyalty. Of course, you wouldn't believe just how powerful that is for success. I have known some very wealthy people, and the one thing I've noticed about them is they're great communicators, and they know how to be kind to one another. They have what is known as emotional intelligence, which is one of the things you cultivate through meditation. You cultivate, if you go to a good temple, church, or mosque, you cultivate the ability to actually to connect with other people, to trust one another, which is so important in business. At a conference many years ago with Angie organized, we had Colin Ash, who was a professor of economics, I think, at Reading University, an advisor to the Bank of England. And he came along and said one of the biggest problems in business he called transaction costs. The amount you have to factor in to costs and profits simply because you cannot trust that your supplier will deliver the goods as is specified in the time they say they will send them. You can't trust people. And also, your customers cannot trust the product you sell to them actually does fulfill the specifications and they will receive it on time. That lack of trust in business, which you all know what I'm talking about, that is a big drag on all economies. Which is one of the reasons why he was saying religion is a positive for business, because it does teach people to be more honest and trustworthy, which lessens these transaction costs and increases the bottom line of your business. When people know they're going to be paid on time, when people know that their product is going to arrive on time and it's going to do the things which it says it will do, you will find that that product's reputation will increase and give it the edge over other products. Your company will be known as someone who can actually supply the goods in the right time to those specifications. Short term, you may not make as much money as these fly-by-night companies who come and go very quickly. But in the long term, you will be very, very successful. In business, honesty, trustworthiness is actually a great plus. In the long term, short term maybe no, long term certainly. So it's one of the reasons why if you can develop that ethos in a company, trust, goodness, emotional intelligence, you'll find the business actually succeeds. My business succeeds because people can trust me. They know if I say I'm going to come and give a talk somewhere, I will come. They know that what I say actually works because I have track record, which means they trust. It's one of the reasons why, you know, my honesty, my trustworthiness, which you've seen over many years, means I have got many invitations, a very popular person to invite to giving talks. This is what happens in my business. It's what happens in your business too. So these are just some little pieces of advice. The last piece of advice I'm going to give you before I open it up for some Q&A is that sometimes you will have problems in your business and difficulties. And businesses focus too much on the difficulties and problems which they face. And they take their successes for granted, which should be the opposite way around. If you have a product, if you have a sales strategy which doesn't work, drop it straight away. Don't even have a meeting and discuss why it went wrong. Because when we focus on what goes wrong, you will find everybody gets disappointed. They lose their motivation. They lose their enthusiasm. When something goes wrong, drop it almost immediately. But when something goes right, you have a market strategy which is successful, a product which really takes off, then have meeting after meeting after meeting to discuss what happened, why it was successful. Because in business, as in life, you learn much more from what went right than you ever learn from what goes wrong. Trying to learn from what goes wrong is like spending too much time in the negativity and the darkness. But when something goes right, a strategy, a product really works, focus on that, learn from that. Keep having meeting a meeting after that. Learn the secrets of success. Let go of the problems when things fail. And then you'll find your workforce will be more motivated. And they will learn from successes rather than just taking them for granted. It's the same with husbands and wives, relationships. Something goes wrong, you have a bad day with your partner. And sometimes that's all we ever think about. Why did it go wrong? Why didn't it work? Please let that go immediately. When you have a wonderful day together, you really enjoy your time with your partner. Think about that. Why did it work? Why do we have so much happiness? Why do we have just a wonderful day together? Learn from successes in life. Never try and learn from what goes wrong. Learn from what goes right. And then your company will be highly successful, motivated, and you'll find those successes will be repeated again and again and again. Buddhism especially has a lot to say about business. And you're in a Buddhist country. You should be using these techniques to advance a country like Sri Lanka, a city like Colombo, to be highly successful in the Buddhist world. Many top CEOs in the United States are Buddhist. Mark Zuckerberg is a Buddhist. Facebook. Many others. He had his house blessed, new house, by a Thai monks. Many Buddhists are leading CEOs. If you're a Buddhist too, like the story I was told, I'm not sure I should tell this story, but I started it. The previous Prime Minister of Thailand, Thaksin, he told me in a little talk that some years ago, the head of Ford Motor Corporation, I think it was Robert Ford, the CEO, he came to Thailand because he wanted to open up a production facility in Thailand. And it was such a major investment that went straight to the Prime Minister, Thaksin, to actually discuss arrangements. And as soon as they came in, so the Prime Minister told me, Mr. Thaksin, Robert Ford said straight away to Prime Minister Thaksin, "You're Thai, do you know a Buddhist monk called Ajahn Chah?" And then Thaksin said, "Yes, I've got his books here." And so instead of talking about the development, they spent the next 2 hours talking about Buddhism. These are CEOs of huge companies in the United States who are so interested in Buddhism. Why? You should have found out from the talk which I have just given you. Because many of the things which we've learned over centuries, Buddhist psychology, Buddhist meditation, Buddhist attitudes, are powerful. And people in the West are making use of them. So certainly people in Sri Lanka, I don't care what religion you are, if it works, use it. So thank you for listening. Some Q&A. And please, I know this is Colombo. You're supposed to be Buddhist, many of you, but I'm a Western monk. So please put aside your conventions and your traditions. You can ask me any question you like. Feel free. It's a Western monk. It's much easier than if it's a Thai monk. Okay, look, I'm going to give a little story which I often give to get the very first question. This is from basic Buddhist teachings about karma and reincarnation. Because in one sutra, the Chula Kama Vibhanga Sutra, they asked the Buddha, why is it that some people are wealthy, other people are poor? Some of you have worked so hard in your company, and it's hard even to make ends meet. And the Buddha said, maybe it's some karma you did in the past. Other people, you know, they just start a business, hardly any problems at all, and they're ridiculously wealthy. And the Buddha said, there is a cause for wealth in your previous life, the karma you did. And it was such a good answer that the man asked a second question. Why is it that some people in this life are beautiful and other people are ugly? You may have noticed when I mentioned the word ugly, I looked at the floor. And the reason is that once I gave this story in Singapore, I just happened to be looking at one girl when I mentioned the word ugly, and she complained. Why did you mention the word ugly when you were looking at me? She said. So the Buddha gave a reason, you know, why some people are ugly while some people are beautiful. And the next question was the most important. He said, why is it that some people are intelligent and other people are stupid? You know, some people, they go to school and they hardly do any work. They get straight A's, they go to universities, and it seems to be so easy for them. Other people, they have to do extra homework, extra tuition, and still they find it difficult to pass their O levels and A levels. And the Buddha said, there's a reason for that, karma from the past. And the Buddha said, the karmic cause for stupidity in your next life, this is important, please listen to this. The karmic reason for stupidity in your next life is because you do not ask questions in this life. Okay, you're asking about transference of merit. Now, there is a phenomenon which many of you may have experienced. If you haven't experienced it yourself, you may have read about it. A sister, a brother, or even a son or daughter may be studying, say, in London, and they have an accident. If you have someone you love, and they say, in a car accident right now in London, you'll feel that something's wrong right now. Now, you will know that something is wrong. And you ring them up, and sure enough, they're in hospital with an accident. How does that work? How is it that someone, you know, your wife, your son, or whatever, is in the other part of the world, and you know straight away something's wrong? That is the connection which we have to people we've known and loved for such a long time. If, say, your mother has just died, that connection is still there. So if you do something for her, dedicated to her, which you know will make her happy. If your mother is a Christian, don't make merit in a Buddhist temple. It might upset her. Make merit in a Christian temple, whatever. So you want to, it's for her, not for you. And so what you're doing is doing something for her, and she will feel that it's for her, it's something good, and she'll be so happy that her daughter is doing something for her. When she gets happy, the merits have been transferred. You've made her uplifted. Give her an extra boost, which is one of the reasons if you're, say, your father or mother is a Buddhist, a particular type of temple they've been supporting all their life, you go and give a donation there. If they've always been working, say, in an old people's home, give a donation to the old people's home. Whatever will make your mother happy, then afterwards think of her. You've just done this for your mum. They will know in the same method that accidents happen and people on the other side of the world know that something's wrong. That's how it works. Okay, we have questions here. Dear sir, please explain as to what you should really concentrate when you take refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha, and also when observe the five precepts. I thought this was supposed to be a business seminar, but it's like Buddhist business. But very quickly, when you take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, you have the opportunity to actually to reflect on what this means for yourself as a Buddhist. You know, the Buddha is the enlightened teacher. So you have faith that what he said must have some power and meaning towards it. So you take refuge, you know, in the enlightenment of the Buddha and the Dhamma, which means that when you do have problems and difficulties in life, you actually need to look to what the Buddha said about this. What do the monks and the nuns say about this? and all these great teachings which are very popular throughout our world, you take refuge in that. I don't know if you saw the British House of Commons recently. Every member of Parliament in the House of Commons meditated for 1 minute. It's only 1 minute, but it's a start. Taking refuge in mindfulness, in kindness, in calmness. And also in the Sangha, in the community of monks and nuns, who are supposed to be, and many do, not everybody, but convey the teachings not just in word, but in practice as well. And I try really hard as a leading monk, not just to speak and teach the Dhamma, but to live it. So many of you, I say, I live a simple life as a very senior monk. For many of you, if you come and see me off on the airport, it's too late to see me off in the airport. If you met me at the airport, my luggage was a little bag. Have you got your little bag here? About that, I think you've probably got more in that bag than I had to come to Sri Lanka. Could you hold it up so people see? That's my luggage, which I travel overseas with. How many suitcases do you have when you travel overseas? So I keep it simple. And if ever you have the opportunity to visit me in Perth, Australia, you can come and visit my cave where I live. Such a simple little cave. I sleep on the floor. There's hardly anything in there. So I try and live what I teach, which is really important. So that way, as a member of the Sangha, you're an example to others of how a simple, peaceful life can give you so much happiness. And observing the five precepts is getting you out of trouble. You know the most difficult precept for people to keep in Sri Lanka? Alcohol. And I will tell you a story. That there was a man, a businessman in Sydney. He was at a party, I think Christmas or New Year, having too much to drink, and he decided to drive home. In Sri Lanka, Australia, many parts of the world, drink driving is so dangerous that the police, if they catch you, they will fine you, even take away your license. But he thought, no, the police won't catch me, I'll take a chance. As it happened, the police were checking every vehicle on one of the main roads he used on his way home. He got caught in a police traffic block. He knew he was over the limit for alcohol. He knew he was in big trouble, but what can you do? He just accepted he'd probably lose his license. When it got to his turn, he got out of the car. Can you please step outside of the car, sir? And they gave him this little tube to blow into. It's called like a breathalyzer, which checks the alcohol level on your breath. He was about to blow into that tube, knowing it would be over the limit, when there was the sound of a car crash. It was a car traveling a little bit too fast. It went into the rear of another car at the police traffic roadblock. And so the policeman heard the sound of the crash and said to this gentleman, "It's more important that I look after this traffic accident than check your breath. Get back in your car and go home." He thought he was so lucky. He literally became within 1 or 2 seconds of getting caught. And the following morning he woke up. Someone was ringing the doorbell of his home. And he had to get up, even though he had a big hangover. He quickly got dressed, opened the door, and at the door were 2 Sydney policemen. And he thought, "I'm doing nothing wrong now. I'm not driving. They can't arrest me." So he relaxed and said, "What do you want?" And they said, "Can we please check inside your garage?" "There's nothing there, only my car." "Sure." And when he opened his garage door, this poor man in Sydney almost had a heart attack. Because in his own garage, it wasn't his car there, there was the police car there. And you can work out yourself what happened. Those are the dangers of breaking the five precepts. Okay. Being a layperson,
of pursuing a career, can you still strive towards enlightenment? How do you enhance your spiritual life and a Buddhist sense living a lay life? As a Buddhist monk, we need you to be successful in your business. That's why I don't mind coming here and teaching business executives. Because the more successful you are in the business, the more donations we get to build our monasteries. But no, it's also, your business is not just for yourself. You employ many people, which means you give a livelihood to hundreds, sometimes thousands of people, so that people can send their children to good schools, they can travel, they can live a comfortable life. So it's not just making money for the CEOs or the shareholders. Everybody benefits from a successful business. The whole country benefits when there's prosperity. So it's important as a Buddhist to try and encourage prosperity. It's not just for you. It's for everybody who works for you. Everybody who has your products. If there wasn't airlines, I would never be able to come here to teach. If there wasn't motor cars, I would have to walk from the house where I'm staying here. These things are important for our society. So well done that you're actually doing a service to the community. So look at your work as a service to others, as dana to the country of Sri Lanka and to the world economy, because your efforts and sacrifice are helping many more people than you can ever imagine. And if you look upon business that way, as not being selfish, but more selfless, seeing the bigger picture, you can understand how it can be a contributor to your eventual enlightenment. It is commonly stated that failures are the pillars of success. Is this contrary to what you declare? Absolutely. Because failures are just what takes away your energy and motivation, makes you depressed and negative. And instead we forget the successes in life. That's where we learn. You learn much more from success than you ever learn from failures. Ask any modern psychologist that. Unfortunately, as human beings, we always tend to collect the failures. I can't resist one of my favorite stories. You can use this in your business when you have to give presentations. The two chicken farmers. And please excuse me for using an unconventional word, S-H-I-T. The reason I use that is because the Buddha actually taught in the Aranyabhuvanga Sutta and in the Vinaya, monks, you should use the local language. He said that. And this is how my teacher Ajahn Chah taught. He said there were two chicken farmers. The first got up early in the morning to collect the produce of the night before. He took the basket, went into the hen house, and filled the basket full of chicken shit, and left the eggs in the shed to rot. He brought the little pellets of dung back into the house, where it made a big stink, and the family were very disappointed with him. He was a very stupid chicken farmer. Chicken farmer number two went into the hen house with the basket, and he filled the basket full of eggs. You left the dung in the shed to become fertilizer later, but you don't take it into the house with you. You take the eggs back into the house where you can make a lovely omelette for your family's breakfast and sell the rest of the eggs in the market for cash. That's a smart chicken farmer. And the meaning of that simile, when you collect what your business has achieved over the past year, do you collect the shit or the eggs? Do you remember all the things which went wrong, all the failures, all the mistakes? If that's what you do, you are, please excuse me, a shit collector. Instead, please remember all the successes you've done in life, in your business. Collect the eggs. Then you're an egg collector. And you leave the shit in the past to rot. Number one, you're motivated. You're energized.
Nothing breeds success more than success. The confidence, the belief that you can succeed. And that's what we do when we remember successes. And too often in life, we forget it. It worked. Why did it work? The Sri Lankan cricket team, why did it win the World Cup a few years ago? Do you know, have I told you that story? Why the Sri Lankan team beat Australia in the World Cup cricket? The reason was, a couple of months before, the Sri Lankan cricket team were playing Australia, maybe a month before somewhere, playing Australia in a practice one-day match in Perth. At lunchtime, the Sri Lankan team were doing terribly. So they asked one of the boys to quickly come to my temple and get 12 pieces of pirit thread for good luck. And so being a very kind monk, I made 12 pieces of pirit thread for their wrists. It was too late for that match. They lost. But a couple of weeks later, the Sri Lankan cricket team beat my team, Australia, in the World Cup. And I remember seeing in the local paper the day after, your captain, Arjuna Ranatunga, holding up the World Cup with my string on his wrist. That is why you won. Have you won since? You haven't asked me for any string. Learn from what works. There is corruption in the corporate sector. How does one survive and succeed with ethical practice? A friend of mine, he had a big business in Sydney. He was going to sign a contract with a Taiwanese firm. And the Taiwanese firm came all the way to Sydney to sign a contract worth several million dollars. When they came, they asked my friend, he said, "We're ready to sign the contract this evening, but we want you to supply us with prostitutes and take us out for free drinks." And my friend is a Buddhist, an Australian, Caucasian, and he said, "No, I keep five precepts. I've got a wife. I'm not going to cheat on my wife. I'm not going to buy you drinks." And the Taiwanese businessman was so upset. They said, "If you don't supply us with drinks in a nightclub and supply us with girls, we're not going to sign your contract." So he had one of these difficult decisions: break his precepts and make a few million, or just forego the profits and keep his integrity. And I'm very proud of him that he decided to keep his precepts. He said, "Deal off." And so he went back home. What happened next is the inspiring part. A couple of hours later, he received a call from those Taiwanese businessmen. He said, "We've been discussing you." And he said, "It's obvious, it's rational. We would rather do business with someone who doesn't cheat on his wife. If he cheats on his wife, he'll probably cheat on us. Are you still up? We're coming round to sign the contract." He got that contract signed. Doesn't it make sense? Who would you rather do business with? If someone is corrupt and cheats others, they're going to cheat you. You cannot trust them. Certainly, corrupt businesses, they make short-term profits. In the long term, you can't trust them. So, would you like to do business with someone you can trust? Or with someone who's corrupt? It's obvious. The trustworthy businesses, they are sustainable. The trust will be one of your great marketing assets. Short-term profits being corrupt, long-term you're in big trouble. Who would you like to do business with? Trust is a marketable commodity. Please, if your businesses are not corrupt, market that point. Promote it. This business is trustworthy. It's something which people will believe in and want to invest in and want to actually to use you. Could you kindly teach a very simple method to practice at work? Yep. When you get to work, have a cup of water, hold it for 3 minutes, see how much it hurts, put it down for 30 seconds, and then hold it up again afterwards. You will experience yourself how when you rest, you can hold something with no problems. Learn how to rest. Your project, your meeting, whatever it is, learn how to put it down for maybe 5 minutes every lunch hour, at least, and you yourself will realize the benefits of energizing your brain, being able to see things afresh, an investment of just relaxation for 5, 10, 15 minutes has enormous rewards. How you relax, that's really up to you. One of the best methods, I'm sure you can find this on the internet, is get what we call a guided meditation. Monks like myself or others, they give a guided meditation, put it on an iPod or a smartphone, put it the earplugs in, and so you can get guided by someone you trust in a little relaxation meditation method. If you try and do that by yourself, your mind will wander all over the place. Guided meditation on iPhone, you can download it, there's so many of them. Plug it in every lunch hour, do that. You'll find the benefits are enormous. Try it and see. I guarantee you'll come back and thank me. One more? Okay, always one more. We usually do 3 last questions. What are we supposed to do when we get angry because of someone? What are we supposed to do when we get angry because of someone below us at work? My goodness, why do you allow people underneath you to make you angry? Don't allow other people to control your emotions. Otherwise, they have power over you. So other people, can they say what they like? If they say things which are not nice, remember, why do you have 2 ears instead of 1? 1 to go in, 1 to go out. So if they say something nasty, let it go all the way out. If they say something kind, put your hand over 1 ear so it doesn't go out, so you can keep it. Don't let other people make you angry. You have the choice not to react. Exercise that choice. It's not worth getting angry. And if you really want to upset somebody, if you really want to upset someone, when they try and make you angry, refuse. Nothing upsets them more than when you don't get upset. What you're doing, the anger just goes straight back to them. There are many, 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 many other ways not to get angry. People say, if people say bad things, it means they're really stupid. Why are you believing a stupid person? Wise people never ever try and make you angry. They're stupid people. So you're just allowing yourself to be as stupid as them. Or if they do say something which is rotten, we call that in Buddhism temporary insanity, when people shout at you. So if someone says something very bad to you, think, oh, you poor person, you must be crazy today. So never be upset at someone who's crazy. They're just mad. We call it brain damage. Would you get upset when somebody shouts at you because they're brain damaged and crazy? So when you go home, if your wife starts scolding you, just remember she's probably crazy today, going through one of the women things. So it's not you. Don't allow yourself to get upset.
I wanted to ask a question related to running Buddhist organizations.
Yeah.
Because in my years of volunteering, what I sometimes find more challenging than working in the corporate world is serving in a Buddhist organization. I'm sure some of you have experience. And since Ajahn Brahm did mention that recently he heard that the admin team at the Buddhist Fellowship had designed, and I thought that it's worth sharing with you that this actually arose from hiring that we made that was a mistake, or rather I term it as a mistake. The person was very efficient, and as it turned out, she drove everybody to work really hard, to the point that she could be very pressuring. And I proposed that we really need to remove this person. But like many executive committees, you don't always get consensus. And when you do end up with a situation like this where one person becomes rather disruptive to the entire organization, you end up splitting the executive committee, which suddenly a Buddhist organization that's supposed to be in the business of promoting morality, wisdom, and mindfulness, it has turned into a political organization, which is why I said I would even step down, because I rather have harmony than to have a political organization out of a Buddhist organization. So I would like to pose this question to Ajahn Brahm, because many of us serve in a Buddhist organization thinking that it would be very meritorious and very rewarding. And it is rewarding spiritually, but it can be extremely challenging to the spiritual well-being of a person. So please advise us accordingly on how to maintain harmony while being effective in being in the business of promoting right speech, right action, right conduct, right effort, and right livelihood. Thank you.
Even if it's not well run, it doesn't have to be organized that well. I tell many people in Australia, if you do not like organized religion, come to our Buddhist temple. We are disorganized religion. But still, people enjoy that friendliness. So, as I mentioned when I gave a little talk at the Buddhist Fellowship in Singapore, you are Buddhist first of all. Keep that as your priority. What you're in business for. And then, the next thing is, in business and in a Buddhist temple, people are far more important than things. It's not just how much money you have in your organization. It's not just the beauty of your temples or how many chandeliers or gold Buddha statues you have. That is not impressive at all. What is impressive is the quality of the people who are part of that organization. What sells your products is the person in front of the sales counter. Their kindness, their enthusiasm for the product. People are far more important than things. And if we can remember that in an organization, instead of getting the work done at the expense of people, we look after the people. The work gets done, the work doesn't get done. That is not as important as the people. In my monasteries, these two monks here have spent time in my monastery. I ordained them. I'm their preceptor. I've often told them I'd rather have a monastery where the grounds are not swept, where the toilets are dirty, but the monks are happy, than a monastery where everything is spotlessly clean, but everyone is so tense. What type of temple would you like to go to? So when we know priorities in life, many people work so hard for their family, but your children never see you. Your priority is wrong. You're working for your family, but you don't see your family. So remember, the family becomes first. That's what you're working so hard for. So remember your family. Spend time with them. Even if it means your career is not advanced. Your career is there for your family, for your happiness, not the other way around. So when you reorder priorities in life and find out what's really important, then your business is successful, and so is your life. And your Buddhist communities are not dysfunctional, because you know what's really, really important. It's a Buddhist society. It's a Buddhist temple. Buddhism is supposed to be compassionate and kind. So please, if you're a Buddhist temple, if you're a Hindu, a Christian, Christian's supposed to be love your neighbor. Not blow up your neighbor. So please be kind. Know what's really important in life. Get the priorities right, and everything else will come afterwards. as many psychologists have proven time and time again, success is not the cause for happiness, but happiness is the cause for success. Again and again, that's been proven. It's a happy company, you will be successful. But if you try and get success first, you're not going to be happy. Okay. Thank you all for listening.
Very beautiful note of it is not success that brings you happiness, but happiness that brings you success. And may all your lives be happy so that you will be successful. And in a traditional way, can we pay our gratitude to him by saying three times, Sadhu, Sadhu, Sadhu.